Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Sloan.
4, 3, 2, 1, booster ignition and lift off. The crew of Artemis II now bound for the moon. Humanity's next great voyage begins.
That was the liftoff of the Artemis II moon flyby mission on April 1st, 2026, marking the first time in 54 years that astronauts from Earth have flown to lunar space. Longtime listeners to this show know I have a very special place in my heart for the Apollo program. Like many my age, I was a starry-eyed, or should I say lunar-eyed, kid who followed every mission to the moon from 1968 to 1972. If you would have told me back then that it wouldn't be until now that astronauts would finally fly beyond low Earth orbit into deep space and around the moon, I would have been shocked. But that's how history has unfolded. And as the saying goes, better late than never. So far, the mission has been spectacular, thanks to the extensive training that the crew participated in, leading to their historic and dramatic observations of the moon during their flyby on April 6th. On that day, three Americans, Commander Reid Wiseman, Pilot Victor Glover, and Mission Specialist Christina Cook, along with Canadian Mission Specialist Jeremy Hansen, flew farther from the Earth than any humans have ever been before, 252,760 miles from our pale blue dot. Thanks to the serendipitous timing of their launch, they also got to see a total solar eclipse, adding more drama and scientific observations to their very full flight plan. Just before the mission, we were joined by NASA Assistant Research Scientist Caitlin Ahrens for an in-depth discussion of the scientific objectives of the mission, and we'll share that with you along with my own personal observations of the mission and some audio from the astronauts themselves. Joining us now is our guest from the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland, planetary scientist Caitlin Ahrens. Caitlin, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you for having me.
And you're joining us to talk about Artemis II, and we'll get to that in a moment. But first, I'd like to know more about you. It's always fascinating to me to find out about people and their paths that lead them to their work, especially when it's at a place like NASA. So when did you first get interested in science in general and geology in particular?
Oh, that's a great question. So I started off as a radio astronomer. I grew up in West Virginia. I was surrounded by the Green Bank Observatory there. And that was pretty much all I knew up until about halfway through my undergrad studies. I then landed an internship doing Mars geology. And I've always been fascinated by astronomy as a hobby, geology as a hobby. And it never occurred to me that people can combine these two. You can have astrogeology. You put astro in front of anything and it sounds cool, right?
Yeah.
And so doing that internship, that was out at the USGS out in Flagstaff, Arizona. And since then, it just sort of snowballed into what can I get my hands on? What kind of planetary bodies can I try to do more research with? My PhD was on Pluto and the New Horizons mission. Now at Goddard, I do mostly lunar stuff and the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. And so it's been just very, very fascinating just bouncing around the solar system now as part of my career. As far as, you know, today I was doing mostly lunar stuff. Tomorrow I might do a little bit of Mars stuff. Maybe next week I do a little bit of more Pluto stuff. And so having that kind of freedom to truly bounce around the solar system and see what I can get up to has been very, very fun.
So when did you get involved in lunar geology really specifically? And how has that led to your role with Artemis?
So as far as the geology and the fascination of the moon, that's always been in the background. You get to learn about craters. Being a planetary scientist, you pretty much have to learn the basics, right? And so the moon is a great way to learn the basics, but I didn't get really into lunar studies until around the pandemic, around 2020. And then started to go into, oh, wait a minute, we're wanting to go back. We're wanting to go into exploration mode again. What still needs to be sought after, why are we going back to the moon? And so all of these open questions now really started to fuel my interest into lunar studies for my current job.
Yeah, and the moon is a fascinating body, and a lot of people don't realize how many interesting geologic questions there are. Just off the top of your head, give us some things that you find the most interesting about the moon.
Oh, goodness. Buckle up. Let's see. There's different kinds of volcanoes across the moon, which means that there would have been different kinds of chemistry, different physics of which those volcanoes would have formed. They're also different regionally as well. Why is that? There's some areas that have very angular and very long collapsed lava tubes, and other places have very sinuous and curvy lava tubes. So why the differences in the shape and angularity there? There's some areas that the minerals are either very darker or very much lighter in certain areas. Why is that? And then certainly a huge question is there's ice. There's ice at the polar regions of the moon. And so you have, you know, these questions about where the origin of the ice is, what kind of chemistry are you dealing with, does it do anything to the craters themselves, and then how does that go into exploration as well?
And as a scientist, you know, you're always wanting to ask questions and find out new things. And the wonderful thing about exploring the moon is we have explored so little of it with the Apollo missions. And now, of course, we have the wonderful science that's come out of the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter over the years. So we have all that data. But there are so many unresolved questions, like you brought some of them up. But let's talk about the ice in particular. Because I remember when I first found out about this was from Gene Shoemaker. We were sitting down at lunch, and he said, "I have something to tell you." And I said, "Well, what's that, Gene?" And he said, "We believe we found ice on the moon." And I was flabbergasted by that. You know, at that time, this was the 1990s, yes, about 1996, nobody thought about there being ices on the moon. And this was information coming back from the Clementine mission that he was involved with. And then, of course, as time's gone on, we have characterized there is ice. But tell us about where that ice is and how we know about it.
That's a very good question. So as far as the ice goes, you need a very dark part of the moon, a very deep, dark crater. If you heard the phrase where the sun don't shine, these craters take it to a literal state.
South Pole Aitken Basin, the sun don't shine much in those deep places.
No, certainly not. And even the North Polar region of the moon as well. So you have differences in the shading and then the different shadowed parts, how deep those craters would be, differences between North and South Pole there. But let's focus on the South Pole of the moon. That's where most of our exploration is going to go toward. And yeah, having these, whether it's bright little specks on radar signatures from Arecibo, when it was in Puerto Rico, or the SOFIA infrared telescope on board a plane at one point as well. All of these different instruments, and then certainly the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, you got LCROSS, the impactor that kind of bumped itself into Cabeus Crater and then gave us some vaporous data about what kinds of, not just water ice, but there's also different kinds of sulfur and different methane, carbon dioxide ice as well. But now the question arises, where did these chemistries come from? And then are all of these shadowed areas the same? And more likely not. So now it's getting into, where do we even want to explore? Water ice behaves very differently, and it's very sensitive to temperatures, and all these different craters have different temperature regimes. They behave differently over lunar seasons, which we have summer and winter. Sorry to disappoint. There's no autumn season on the moon. It's not like a crater is going to turn orange for you during the autumn.
Caitlin, can you give our listeners a sense of the temperature extremes you can encounter on the moon?
Yes. So the temperature extremes here, we're talking as cold as Pluto in some of these areas. We're talking a very blustery, very nippy, negative 440 Fahrenheit, at least. Some areas can get even colder. We're talking even Pluto winter in some of these areas. So some of those would certainly be the riskier, deeper craters that we may not be able to explore right away. But it's really interesting to know that they're there. They're there for future exploration to know, you know, why is that one different? Why is that crater over there different than this other crater that may not be as cold? It may not be as nippy over in one particular crater versus the other. And so how might those kinds of different ices differ between different craters all across the polar region? And even that's still a very much open question.
And it's interesting because when we think about exploring the moon and returning with the Artemis program and hopefully going forward in the future, if humans are going to establish a presence on the moon, they're going to need resources. And of course, water is a precious resource. You know, you can use it for so many things, not just to drink, but also you can, you know, break it down into hydrogen and oxygen. You can turn it into fuels. You can do all kinds of things with it. So I would imagine, you know, that the chasing the water on the moon is the big deal of exploration.
Absolutely. And this needs to be the time to do it. So there's two things about this. One, you're correct. How do we explore it? What does this mean for sustainability? But also shorter term, how do we even sample it in the first place? How do you sample something that is potentially as cold as Pluto and bring it back to Earth to study, to know if is it an actual viable resource going forward? And so that is very much a shorter term goal. So that way we can plan ahead. And also how much of this stuff is really around. Is it deep? In which case we need to get our technology ready to go deeper. Is it maybe not as stable as we think it is? So we need to be prepared for that. Maybe there's really not that much as we think there is. In which case, do we need to start preparing to bring our own bottled water, make a water plant up on the moon? Who knows? But we need to start planning these things and asking these questions now before it's too late, or before we start building and then maybe something bad happens or something we realize, oh, there's not as much as we thought there was.
Yeah. And you can't know unless you go actually look. Humans need to be a part of that equation. And of course, robotics can also be a huge aid. Well, let's talk a bit about this Artemis II mission. Let's do a little compare and contrast with this mission with the one that's the most analogous to it, which would be Apollo 8, which was the first time that humans went around the moon. And we just lost Jim Lovell recently, who was the last crew member to be alive from that mission. So that to me was just such a historic event, December 24th, 1968, when we first saw, you know, what the Earth looked like rising from the moon. And humans haven't been back there, of course, since 1972 with the Apollo 17 flight. So let's talk about the mission profile for this, because it's very different. Tell us about, you know, what we're trying to achieve with the Artemis II.
So there's two different things. One is the orbit, and then one is the experiments. So let's chat orbit real quick. So Apollo 8, anytime you see a poster of Apollo 8, it looks like a figure eight, where it zips around the Earth, and then it does 10 beautiful somersault orbits around the moon, and then right back to Earth. And so
pretty low lunar orbit. They were only about 60 miles above the moon.
Exactly. So
they were very close. And they, you know, and the difference to me with this one and that one is they went into orbit, whereas this one is not. Explain to us why this is not going into orbit.
Yes. So this one's not going into orbit because we need a dress rehearsal. We'll make sure we know how to get to the South Pole of the moon. So South Pole of the moon, we've never attempted this before, especially with a crewed and very large rocket before. So we want to make sure we kind of get the angle of attack, if you will. What's our strategy of getting to the polar region and also going just slightly further away in altitude. So it's not going to go around the moon multiple times like Apollo 8. It's actually going to do several orbits around the Earth, but getting a little bit farther from the Earth ever so slightly. We call it the kidney bean, is essentially what the orbit is going to look like as it's going further and further and further out from Earth. Then it's going to slingshot its way to the moon, and it's going to do just one pass around the moon, slinging out farther. We're talking about nearly 6,000 miles altitude as opposed to the 60 miles altitude that Apollo 8 had. So about 6,000 miles altitude around the moon, and then free fall back to Earth. So it's going to be quite the slingshot of an orbit going to the moon. And it's only going to take 10 days. So about 10 days, full active days for those astronauts to get there, to do as much as they possibly can. But another thing about this altitude, though, because Apollo 8 was only at 60 miles altitude, it's almost like you're putting your hand close to your nose. You can only see, you know, very well, you know, besides going cross-eyed, you can only see very, very fine features of your palm, but you're not able to see your whole hand, essentially.
You're not getting the big picture.
Exactly. So Artemis II, because it has a farther view of field, we're seeing parts of the far side of the moon the Apollo 8 astronauts never saw.
We're going to take a short break, but before we do, let's listen into one of the most dramatic and historic moments of the Artemis II mission, the moment they fired their engines to leave Earth and head to the moon in a maneuver known as TLI, or Translunar Injection, a call that last came from Mission Control in Houston back in December of 1972.
Integrity, Houston has completed the poll for TLI. When the engine ignites, you embark on humanity's lunar homecoming arc and set the course to return Integrity and her crew safely home. Houston is go for TLI.
Integrity copies, and your Integrity crew is go for TLI. With this burn to the moon, we do not leave Earth. We choose it.
I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot.
The moon is so bright when you come back to the window. I was just in the interior of the cabin. I've come back to T-shirt window, and it's just overwhelming brightness. We've been talking about some shades, and so we have the dark and the light gray, and then we've talked about naming some colors, a brownish hue and a greenish hue. And I'll tell you, like, right now, Aristarchus, the plateau is hard for me to see from this window, but that had greenish hues to me and was very unique. I didn't see anything like that anywhere else on this side of the moon.
That was Canadian astronaut Jeremy Hansen telling science officer Kelsey Young about his observations of the colors on the moon during the historic Artemis II flyby of the moon on April 6th. Let's return now to our discussion of Artemis science with NASA research scientist Caitlin Ahrens. Let's talk about the science that they're going to do, because they're not going to be landing on the moon, as you said, but there is some interesting science on board. Tell us about that.
Yes. So this is really exciting. And another really fun talking point, too, with people is like, well, wait a moment, they're not landing on the moon. What could they possibly be doing up there? And it's not to say that we're giving them fancy cameras and take a bunch of pictures while they're up there. That is part of their job. Pretty, you know, very pretty please take a lot of pictures for us geologists so we can do more mapping and so on. But a lot of the experiments that the astronauts are going to be doing are biomedical. And this is something still very newish to the planetary community, especially for longer-term exploration. Now, we've done some medical experiments, but very, very little with the International Space Station.
And that environment, Caitlin, is so different than the deep space environment, because you've passed through the Van Allen radiation belts to go out to the moon, which protect the Earth from a lot of solar radiation, whereas the astronauts on the space station are somewhat protected from that. So that's absolutely true. They're going to be exposed to a different environment than humans have in a very long time.
Exactly. And even with Apollo, we had some sensors with the suits and even little radiation markers within their suits and on their skin while they were on the surface. But they were only there for just a few days, come back home. And it wasn't really quite advanced. We understood that it was a risk, but now we need to start learning and worrying about this when we're wanting to go to the moon and stay longer. And so there's going to be some really fun biomedical type experiments. There's one in particular I'm really looking forward to. You got to love acronyms. This one's called AVATAR, which stands for a Virtual Astronaut Tissue Analog Response.
I always wonder about those when they have an actual thing like AVATAR. You know, how long did somebody spend figuring out how do we take what this is and turn it into a cool acronym?
I will tell you, most science teams, even the ones that I've worked on, we have a lot of fun when it comes to making acronyms. So I could probably guarantee that the AVATAR team had a lot of fun making theirs.
That's what you guys do. You sit around and you have coffee and say, let's make acronyms.
Absolutely. We'll have whole acronym meetings. It's great.
Well, tell us about AVATAR.
Yes. So AVATAR is little tiny cells that are going to have blood and skin samples of each of our four astronauts. Then they will be exposed to the outside of the rocket as they are going to and from Earth. And these different markers will be exposed to different points along the way. So just within Earth's Van Allen belts, as you're approaching the moon, as it's at the moon, and then as you're coming back. So four different little cells, probably even more than that, getting exposed to different levels of radiation and different paths going to the moon. And so this is to not only give us clues as to those differences, even just a simple path as going to the moon and the radiation can be wildly different, but also how might the human skin cells and the blood samples differ, especially between different human bodies. Every body is different. And so what does that look like going forward? Can results from AVATAR and even other biomedical experiments that they're going to have be going toward almost like a customized medical kit, a personalized medical kit for each of the astronauts with Artemis and beyond?
Wow. Yeah, that's interesting. And another thing just occurred to me is another risk is that we are in a period of maximum solar activity right now with a lot of aurora activity that people have probably become aware of watching their phones saying, hey, you might see the aurora even where you live. That can be a big deal if there is a solar flare event and those particles are directed at the Earth as the astronauts are going around the moon. I'm not sure if you know about this, but how carefully are they monitoring the sun in communicating that to the Artemis team?
So this is great about NASA in general, is that the Heliophysics Division is starting to ramp up a lot of solar weather forecasting models. So very similar to, okay, mm-hmm. you know, what's the temperature like in California for the next few days? Well, here's our prediction, you know, here's your highs and lows, and you know, what's your humidity levels like for the next few days too, and how does that change? And can we get to that level almost like daily resolution for a solar weather forecast? And so the heliophysics division with NASA is working together with planetary scientists to try to make that happen. That would be really exciting for us to start planning out so short of time span and go, hey, I want to launch during this window. Do you think you could give me a forecast as to what the sun might be doing in the next week? And, you know, let's see what that can happen for us too. And then can we use that once astronauts are already there, we're starting to stay longer, that weather forecast is going to be really, really important to warn astronauts on the surface going, hey guys, you got a X class, you know, coronal mass solar ejection, flare. Solar flare coming your way. You got so many minutes to like go take cover.
Because that can be lethal for an astronaut on the moon. That the exposure to that kind of radiation, even in a spacesuit, if you were on the moon and directly hit by that class of solar flare particles, that could be lethal.
Absolutely. And so if you're in a certain open crater, you may not get a really good choice for duck and cover unless you're hopefully close to your module to hide in, or even a large covered rover, if you will. We're starting to design very much larger, almost minibus sized rovers. Can they hide in there as well? And so all of these different risks are starting to kind of come out of the woodwork, if you will. And it makes my job more interesting because that's a little bit about what I do is the risk analysis, some risk models, you know, the what if scenarios.
Tell us about some of that. Tell us about some of the risk scenarios that you come up with that might be interesting to our listeners, because a solar flare definitely sounds very scary to me, but there's other risks.
Oh, there's dozens and dozens of risks for sure. Anything from tool usage or suits maybe not being appropriate for those deep, dark craters. What do we do about that? What if the ice is deeper than we thought? How does that become a risk for time and cost? We want to 3D print from the lunar soil, so we don't have to bring materials back and forth from the Earth. So that brings down our cost and transport. But when we bring, say, 3D printers, if any listener out there has tried 3D printing for the first time, usually it doesn't go well on the first time. The nozzle messes up. It can like squirt the plastic all over the place. That's still a risk on a larger scale. If we want to 3D print lunar soil on the moon, how cool is that to even think about to build 3D printed structures on the moon? But what happens if your building collapses or it doesn't print carefully or right away? So now you got safety risks involved. And then dust. Lunar dust is our absolute worst risk when it comes to the moon.
Yes. Tell us about why lunar dust isn't like the dust bunnies under your bed.
Yeah, certainly not like the dust bunnies under the bed. I wish we had dust bunnies. No, so think of it this way then. So anybody out there or even, you know, Dave, you're out in California. Do you like to go to the beach?
Love the beach. I don't live near it, but when I get a chance, I love the beach and grew up next to it.
But say you're walking down the beach before you get back in your car, you're able to just, you know, just
kick that stuff off.
Yeah, exactly. Kick it off, brush it off. You brush off the sand. So sand on Earth is rounded by wind and by liquid water, by some sort of moving water there. And so it's almost like playing with Play-Doh. You kind of roll it in your hands a little bit. It's because
it feels good in your feet and your toes when you're on a nice sandy beach, that nice soft beach sand.
Exactly. But that's because it's rounded. On the moon, there's no wind, there's no liquid water. So what you have are just very talon sharp little glass grains. Most of it is glass from the volcanoes all across the moon from billions of years ago, broken down into glass shards. So, so tiny that it can break the blood-brain barrier. These things are just toxic to humans. They can stick in your lungs. They can damage your eyes. They can you can develop silicosis, which, by all means, that's a hazard we have here on Earth for anybody who deals with construction or has to deal with asbestos. But for the moon, it's everywhere. And Apollo astronauts nearly lost very critical equipment from this dust simply by just walking around. So the best analogy for this dust is flour as well. So the lunar surface is actually quite dense. If you ever try to pick up a sack of flour, it's quite heavy, right? You know, you don't want to tell someone to pound flour, but if you try to, you can hurt your hand. But you try to pick up a cup of that stuff and make brownies, it's going to get everywhere. It goes poof. And flour is everywhere. Lunar dust is the same, where just because it's hard on the surface, as soon as you start walking around, that stuff gets kicked up and it wants to land somewhere. It's going to stick to your spacesuit. It's going to stick to metals around it. It's going to start.
Why is it so adherent? Because I know that from, you know, talking to the astronauts, that it just gets everywhere and it's hard to get off. Why is it that it adheres so much? Is it because of it's that shard glassy quality that it has?
Not only that, but on a natural level, it's statically charged.
Ah, so it clings.
Yes.
Oh, it really is. Lunar dust is nasty stuff, isn't it, Caitlin?
Absolutely. And so it's inevitable. So it's a risk that we have to just work around. And so it's not like we can fully get rid of the dust. It's everywhere. But how do you mitigate it? How do you make sure that it's workable? There's workarounds for our tools, for our suits, for long day's work on the moon. You want to go back to your habitable space. How do you make sure that dust doesn't just follow you right in? And so technologies of how to mitigate that kind of dust and the workarounds and certainly the risks involved with that too, both on a human health level, equipment level, spacesuit level, every kind of level you could think of, that all gets broken down. And that's all stuff that we're working on right now, because we got to figure that out right now.
Yeah, you can't live on the moon and work on the moon without conquering the problem of the dust. Okay, maybe one more. What's one more interesting hazard before we move on?
Let's see. Another interesting hazard would probably be just the resources in general. Again, building on the moon, we want to also process iron. And so you talk to anybody in construction, you need to know how good your metal is, you know, how bendy your metal is, how well can you melt it down. And it's called grade. Like how well is your grade of ore? And that's something that we haven't figured out yet for the moon, because we haven't processed anything on the moon yet. And so if we're wanting to build and mine these sort of resources, we need to really take a hard look at our technology to figure that out. Can we process as much as we think we can on the moon? And if not, we need to start, you know, switching tactics or strategies, maybe go explore other places on the moon and really hone in on what our technology can and cannot do at this time.
And you deal with characterizing, you know, mineral resources and things on the moon, especially around the South Polar region that we're interested in exploring. One of the things that Harrison Schmitt, the last astronaut to walk on the moon that's still alive from Apollo 17, was very interested in is something called helium-3 as an energy resource. Is that something still of interest?
Absolutely. And it goes back to how do we process it? We understand that it's there, but it's almost like catching mist at this point. How do you sample something that we've never sampled before? How do you make sure that it does not get contaminated either, whether by human and robotic interactions? Maybe the dust can almost house it and cover it in some way. How much is enough as well? That's also another risk too. Whatever you want to do with this helium-3, you need to understand how much of, you know, what's the abundance level here? What are you going to do with it? How do you process it? And so, yes, absolutely. Can we use this as a resource? Very similar to the moon ice. We would like to use it as a resource. We need to figure out a way to sample it first.
We're going to take a final short break before we return to our discussion of the science behind the Artemis II mission with NASA Goddard Space Flight Center Assistant Research Scientist Caitlin Ahrens. But first, let's listen in to astronaut Christina Cook talking about her experience making some dramatic observations of the moon during their flyby on April 6th.
We had, I think, a very successful talking through of some contacts between different color areas, both in the mare and in the highlands, and we identified some really unique texture areas as well. At one point, towards the end of the images of my time in Window 3, I just had an overwhelming sense of being moved by looking at the moon. It lasted just a second or two, and I actually couldn't even make it happen again. But something just drew me in suddenly to the lunar landscape, and it became real. And the truth is, the moon really is its own unit. Body in the universe. It's not just a poster in the sky that goes by. It is a real place. And it, when we have that perspective and we compare it to our home of the Earth, it just reminds us how much we have in common. Everything we need, the Earth provides, and that in and of itself is somewhat of a miracle.
I'm Dave Schloem, and you are listening to Blue Dot.
It was very moving to look out the window. As we continue to explore, when we actually do go down there to the surface, I know for safety reasons that we would never send someone alone, but I just want to really emphasize how important the discussion time was. When we started to talk, we not only got better science discussion, we got better human connection, and so doing this as a pair, we just learn and grow together, and that's just super important, so thank you for adding that to this plan.
That was Artemis II pilot astronaut Victor Glover talking about the importance of their scientific training and collaboration while observing the dramatic lunar landscape during their flyby on April 6th. Let's continue now with our conversation with NASA research scientist Caitlin Ahrens as we discuss the science behind the historic Artemis II mission, marking the first time in more than half a century that humans embarked on a deep space voyage to the moon. Back during the Apollo missions, the first ones, Apollo 11 in particular and 12, and then later on they kind of figured out it didn't seem to be an issue. They were worried about possibly bringing back some kind of organisms from the moon, that there might be some life form there that we have no idea about, and you don't want to accidentally bring that back to Earth. They went through a lot of things to try to keep that from happening, quarantining the astronauts and stuff like that. But my question for you is, with now that we understand about these ices and these interesting places and the deep craters around the pole areas, are we interested in possibly sampling those in an astrobiology sense?
Absolutely. And the contamination is still a bit of an issue, though. We still need to be careful on how to make sure to sample something that could be very thermally unstable, and it could just sublimate as soon as you look at it.
Explain what sublimation is for people who might not know.
Yes, so sublimation is where you have a solid, say like the ice, a solid ice cube, and then it goes poof right into the gas phase. It just skips right over the liquid phase, doesn't even turn into a liquid.
Well, people probably have seen that before with dry ice, carbon dioxide ice. You see it, you know, that's why they use it at rock concerts to make that cool fog effect.
Yes.
Going from straight from the solid to the gas form. And that's also why your ice cubes shrink over time in your freezer, even, you know, even though your freezer's just fine. It's like, why are my ice cubes getting smaller?
Exactly. So we don't want the moon ice to get smaller due to something on our end. So as far as contamination goes, that's still a you know, big question mark. Make sure we know what we're doing and how to do it. But on an astrobiological sense, absolutely. That goes into the origins of this ice. Can it preserve anything that we haven't really quite thought about? Now, I'm not saying it's going to preserve moonworms or anything like that, but maybe, you know, little tiny bits of compounds that we need to be aware of as we're sampling it, but also make sure we're not introducing anything of ours organically into the ice and then let it get preserved going forward as well. So it's a little bit of a back and forth scenario there.
Yeah, and that's got to be a tremendous challenge, that planetary protection that goes both ways.
Exactly. And that's exactly what it's called, backward and forward contamination.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Well, for you going forward, what are some of the things you're going to be working on, you know, after this mission that you're excited about?
After this mission, there's still plenty to work on. There's still plenty of risks to model, to get ready for discussions. I'm working on a few teams to figure out how to sample that moon ice carefully as well. So what's the design of the container going to look like? What kind of command of operations do we need to sample that ice and bring it back to Earth safely, carefully, without melting or sublimating that very delicate moon ice as well? And then also just more moon geology as well. There's still plenty to do. There's some weird geology out there. It's going to keep me busy.
I hope for you personally, someday, you know, when we start to bring samples back from the moon, that you get to interact with some of those samples someday.
I hope so. But I'm more concerned and excited when we actually bring a sample back. It might take a little while. It might have some failures along the way. But knowing that we're designing, we're discussing things right now, we're modeling things like crazy, it's exciting times.
Very exciting times. And thanks for joining us and sharing your passion for the moon and exploration and getting people fired up for this incredible mission to return to lunar space for the first time since 1972. It's very exciting. It's been a long time coming, I must say.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks to our guest, Assistant Research Scientist Caitlin Ahrens from NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. And now for some final thoughts on the historic Artemis II mission, I'm joined by our producer, Matt Fidler. Matt?
Hey, Dave. How you doing?
Good, Matt. Before we go any farther, I'd like to get your impressions of Artemis II, because you've been helping to make all of our historic Apollo programs. When we did the Apollo at 50 series, you've gotten to listen to and edit interviews with astronauts who walked on the moon, flight controllers from Houston, people involved in the Apollo program as scientists. So to finally see in your lifetime, this is the first time you've gotten to see astronauts go out to the moon. What was it like for you?
Well, yeah, because of all those things you just said, you know, this mission means that much more to me. I know how much effort and time and energy and practice and patience that this mission has taken. And so, yes, I have this great appreciation for it like never before. And it was amazing, you know, watching this, going to NASA.gov and kind of seeing where they were and seeing some of the live video. But one of the other things that really excites me is, and that I've really come to understand from, you know, doing all these Apollo shows with you is, you know, after all the Artemis missions are finished with, what kind of technological and scientific advancements that might come from these that we can't even necessarily predict right now.
Absolutely. Those spinoffs in technology and pushing the boundaries of what we can do, they always create new opportunities for exploration in the future.
Yeah, that's really exciting. And speaking of the Apollo missions, you know, there have been a lot of comparisons between Artemis 2 and Apollo 8, and then as well as Apollo 13. Well, can you talk a little bit about those comparisons between Artemis 2 and then Apollo 8 and Apollo 13?
Sure. Let's start with Apollo 8. Let's do a little compare and contrast. Like Apollo 8, no moon landing involved here. But unlike Apollo 8, this mission did not go into orbit around the moon. In Apollo 8, they were orbiting at about 60 miles elevation. Here they did what's called a free return trajectory, where they just loop around the moon using the gravity assist from the moon to slingshot back to Earth. And so they were much farther from the moon, which helped them set a distance record, breaking the one from Apollo 13. Now, to compare it with Apollo 13, they were also on a free return trajectory, but that was because they had to, because of the explosion of the oxygen tank. In this case, it was planned. And it's a good, safe way to go about testing the spacecraft, because this is the first time that they've ever flown the Orion spacecraft with humans on board. So I think it was the perfect combination of something risky and daring going out to the moon without going into orbit. So I think it was the perfect flight plan.
Another thing that's happening on, you know, Artemis 2 is that there's some science happening. It's not just a test flight. So what are some of the scientific things that have jumped out for you as you've been watching this mission unfold?
Well, I'm mindful that it was primarily a test flight because, again, this is the first crewed mission on the Orion spacecraft, and you're testing all these systems. You have to see how it functions in space with a crew. But at the same time, they did do lots of cool science, and they put science front and center. What I was impressed by was one person in particular, science officer Kelsey Young, who was in mission control, had her seat, the science officer. We've never had that in mission control before. So that was a new thing. And I so enjoyed her give and take interactions with the astronauts, prompting them to listening to their observations. That was really cool. And you could tell that they had all worked together and their training really paid off with the astronauts making eloquent observations of so many cool things. They got to see an eclipse, a total eclipse of the sun. During that, they saw meteor impacts, which got Dr. Young very excited. I don't think anybody expected them to see meteor impacts. They thought maybe, but they did see them. And so that was exciting. Their descriptions of the colors, the browns, the greens around the Aristarchus Plateau. Those are things that only, you know, the human eye can really discern. And as we always say, you know, pictures don't do it justice, and they never quite do. There's nothing like the actual human eyeball to experience things firsthand. And their descriptions were wonderful. Like, they got to see Mars and Saturn during the eclipse, and just their descriptions of the Terminator, the dramatic light and day line on the moon, where you see the dramatic relief and the shadows of the deep craters. You could tell they found that to be very dramatic and exciting.
All right. Well, finally, you know, you've been an Apollo historian for quite a while, and you know people that worked on that program. And so this must, you know, have kind of a personal aspect for you as well, watching this mission, you know, over 50 years after you watched the Apollo missions. What were some of your most memorable moments for you?
Yeah, certainly. A memorable moment was getting a phone call from Jerry Griffin, who took time out of his very busy schedule because he's very much in demand this week, and just to tell me how cool it was to stand in mission control 54 years after he stood there for the last time. You know, they sent humans to the moon, astronauts to the moon. That was really special to him, and it was special to me because he's my friend. And just to think of all the astronauts and people that I've known over the years, flight controllers, engineers, scientists who were involved with Apollo, finally getting to see the United States return to lunar space. It was really, you know, made me proud and happy for them. The thing that really, I don't know, the one moment that gave me goosebumps was watching the Earth setting behind the moon and knowing that the astronauts were going to, at that point, when it set, lose signal, LOS, we call it, loss of signal, and that would last for 40 minutes. But what was cool is they always reported that they enjoyed that 40 minutes of quiet time when they couldn't, you know, be chattered at from Houston. They got some, you know, got a little quiet time to themselves, and they enjoyed that. They famously ate some maple cookies in honor of Canadian Jeremy Hansen. So that was neat. I really appreciated that. But I think the thing that stood out for me the most was the eloquence of pilot Victor Glover. You know, back when Apollo 8 famously orbited the moon on Christmas Eve and the astronauts read from Genesis and the Bible, that was very moving. On this mission, they were at the moon close to Easter, and Victor Glover made some moving and beautiful comments reflecting that. And no matter what your religious points of view are or lack thereof, his words were really moving, just like they were on that magical Christmas Eve back in 1968. Let's listen to Victor Glover's words to close the show, Matt.
Let's.
And as we get close to the nearest point to the moon and farthest point from Earth, as we continue to unlock the mysteries of the cosmos, I would like to remind you of one of the most important mysteries there on Earth, and that's love. Christ said in response to what was the greatest command, that it was to love God with all that you are. And he also, being a great teacher, said the second is equal to it, and that is to love your neighbor as yourself. And so, as we prepare to go out of radio communication, we're still going to feel your love from Earth and to all of you down there on Earth and around Earth. We love you from the moon.
Houston copies. We'll see you on the other side.
Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Chico State Enterprises and licensed to California State University Chico in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space and the moon, we all live on a pale blue dot.